I know he's at first. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
Well, everybody, welcome to another edition of You Have Trotted Me Radio. I've got a really special guest tonight. This is Joseph P. Martino will be joining us. He's the author of probably what I think is one of the most important books you'll ever read in your life, if not the most important book, Resistance to Tyranny. You can find his book on Amazon. We've got a link. We've got links and everything up for it in the chat room at the top of the website in big yellow letters so you can't miss it, Resistance to Tyranny. We're playing our previous two interviews with Joseph P. Martino about his book just before the show. So if you weren't able to listen to those, we're going to be restreaming this broadcast and those two and the previous two interviews right after we end this show, or right after we end this interview or this broadcast. So you'll be able to listen to them then again. If you miss them or you want to download them, they're available for download. All you have to do is go into the RSS feed from the old Blog Talk show. The link is at the bottom right-hand corner of the website. Listen to old Blog Talk, to the old Blog Talk radio archives. I truly believe that this book, Resistance to Tyranny, a primer, it's just that, it's a primer. It's to get you thinking about all the things that you might have to consider if you're ever faced with the idea that you might have to resist tyranny in the future. I truly believe, Gary Hunt has stated, has expressed this opinion as well, that this book should be in the hands of every militia person out there, every member of a militia out there, and there should be several copies in every Committee of Safety's library. This book particularly needs to be read and reread again. I myself have read this book to the point that I actually broke it. I think I read the book 13 times in a 2-month period. Cover to cover was probably the vast majority of those, at least 10 times that I read it cover to cover. I used to carry it with me and read it wherever I went. In fact, I ended up losing it that way. Luckily, Smiter bought several copies of the book that he was giving out and handing out to people, and he sent me another one up. Here's sure that I'm going to be ordering a few more copies, and I'm going to be sending them out to people that I think truly need them that can't afford them. There's a couple of people that I know that are in really bad financial straits, but they desperately want to read this book, so I'll be doing that as well. I would encourage everybody to do likewise. You spent 10 years writing this book, and a lot of thought went into it. In fact, when you look at the plan that Gary has worked up, the abbreviated version, the full-length version, whichever one you look at, and you compare that to what is written in this book, it all correlates and lines up with they correlate and line up with each other. So to really grasp the finer aspects of what we're discussing in the plan, this book is a perfect match for that. So this is the only product I've ever promoted on this show. I don't hustle everybody else's products and DVDs, stickers and stuff. This show is not about consumerism. I'm not here to make money. This book, though, I break my rules with this book. This book is by far one of the most important books I've ever read in my life. So, without further ado, I want to bring on Joseph P. Martino, retired colonel. Joseph, welcome to You Have Trotted Me again.
Thank you, Randy. I'm glad to be here on your show.
Always glad to have you. It was been a little bit. I took a couple of month hiatus. I had to take a break from the internet. Never really been on the internet before. And you had a little hiatus that you were taking too, a sabbatical, if you will. And you're now back home. And I'm really excited that we were able to get you on so quickly.
Well, I'm still not unpacked from my trip, but I'm glad to be here anyway.
Hang on one second. Seems that we're having a... Seems that people in the chat room are saying the live stream isn't live. They're getting the old stream, but I'm showing that it is live.
Hey, we're good to go. I was listening to it for a spot check a second ago. We are live. That's
okay.
Odd.
All right, well, I'll head over to the chat room, refresh the page, or hit... Okay, there we go. It's live. Never mind. We're good to go. So, Joe, we had two previous interviews with you on. We covered a tremendous amount of ground. We covered some incredible topics that really need to be delved into. So now it's time to move on. You wanted to talk about a couple of different things specifically before, as we started off, and then to see where that leads to. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to hand this over to you, and I'll let you bring up where we're going to go, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, fine. Well, one of the issues, I think the potential resistors need to be aware of is the need for both an overt and a covert organization. Now, it's not enough to get a bunch of people to head for the hills with guns. You need back home. You need somebody will appeal to the public in a nonviolent way. Somebody who will be appealing to the public and saying, this is what needs to be done. We need to change this, or things are not right. So that in addition to the actual armed resistance, you need a group that can act politically in a nonviolent fashion, calling for strikes, or demonstrations, or doing picketing, or pamphleteering, graffiti, guerrilla theater, other means of getting the word to the public that there is a resistance, but it's not all just violence. It has a political goal. The communists were very strong on this. They recognized that, as Clausewitz put it, war is politics conducted by other means. Well, you have to have the other means. You have to have the politics as well as the armed wing of the resistance. Somebody who will say, what we're fighting, what we're asking for, not what we're fighting for, what we're asking for is, just to pick a possible example, free elections with international supervision. It's a little hard to argue with that. Anyone who says, well, no, we don't want that, is obviously not having the best interests of the public at heart right off the bat. So if you say we have a non-violent group, a group which is ostensibly politically oriented, then they can make these kinds of claims. They can call for demonstrations. If the situation warrants it, they might even call for a strike. But they can put up posters, do pamphleteering, ways of getting the public involved that do not immediately involve fighting. So there's a need for both the overt and the covert group. And the difficulty comes in linking the two. It's very important that that there be no apparent link between the two. You don't want the government to be able to say, well, these people calling for a strike are just the shills for those rebels out there in the hills that are shooting at us. They must appear to be independent. But at the same time, they really do have to be linked in the sense of pursuing a common strategy. And I can't emphasize strategy too strongly. You have to decide ahead of time, what is it that you want? If you don't know what you want, like the old saying, if you don't know where you're going, any map will do. But you have to have a goal and you have to have a strategy for getting there. And that's why the overt and covert groups have to be following a common strategy, even if they are apparently independent of one another.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned that this had to be a non-political group, correct?
I'm sorry, repeat that, please.
You had mentioned that the overt group had to be a non-political group, correct?
Not. It'd be non-violent, but it may be political in the sense that it takes political action that may support. Suppose you're in a situation where you never have elections. Well, suppose the overt group says, we want free elections internationally supervised. Well, that might sound political. The question would be then, do they really want to back specific candidates? Well, maybe they would. In the Polish case, Solidarity did back specific candidates. In the Polish case, before they were able to get legitimate candidates on the ballot, their campaign was cross out the single name. The communist ballot had only one name for each office. So you could call it political if the campaign was cross out the single name. In effect, vote against them by not... You don't have an opportunity to vote against them, but you don't have to vote for them. And you can make your case by saying we're crossing out all these people. So, yes, it can be political, but it would be in the sense of being involved in nonviolent activities that attempt to induce the government to take specific actions, like raise wages or allow a free press or whatever. So it's political in that sense, but it would depend on the circumstances whether they really should back a specific candidate or a specific party.
Okay.
There have been cases, as I mentioned in the Polish case, where they Solidarity was the only alternative. So the overt group backed it. But there are other cases where there may be multiple parties that are not really allowed to run meaningful candidates. So the overt group should be arguing these people ought to be allowed to run meaningful candidates without making a specific choice among them. It depends on the circumstances what you're up against.
Okay.
The overt is the one that's making the case and doing it openly. And the overt group wants to be in the position of saying to the government, unless you negotiate with us, you're going to have to deal with these people who have taken up arms.
Oh, thank you, that's fine.
So that's one of the reasons that it's important to hide the link between the two. Now, in the case of in Ireland, the Irish Republican Army and Sinn Féin were obviously, everybody knew they were linked, but they maintained the fiction that they were independent. And so Sinn Féin eventually was allowed into the government, actually acting as a political party. But that was against the British. You probably couldn't have gotten away with that against the Soviets. It's important, depending on how tyrannical the tyranny is, it's important to keep the two apparently distinct, so that the overt group can act without compromising the activities of the covert group and vice versa. The covert group can carry out its raids or whatever, and the overt group doesn't get the blame. They don't. They're not stuck with the blame for whatever is done by the armed wing.
Okay. Well, you had mentioned in your book that that the tactics of the overt group would have to vary depending upon the type of tyranny they were facing. You brought to light Gandhi, for instance. If Gandhi was facing anybody else, you know, had been facing Hitler or a Stalin, well, that would, there would have been a big difference in the outcome of his little overt operation there.
I doubt anyone would ever have heard of him. He would have disappeared into an unmarked grave. He knew what he was up against. He was up against the people that could be shamed.
So now when you're talking about the overt group and their operations, basically hearts and minds type situation, you know, winning the hearts and minds of the local people.
Right.
It's going to vary depending upon the country, the culture, the people there. But what are some of the actions that they could bring to light? Activities, and so how would they get the word out to let people know this is what we're about, this is what we're against? You had mentioned propaganda, leafleting, and things like that, but, I mean, is there specific things that they should look at?
Well, the basic thing they want to get across is change is possible. It doesn't have to be this way. And then they have to give some practical approaches to getting some kind of change. What does it take to get some independent parties on the ballot? What does it take to get the candidates of those parties allowed to campaign on television and in the newspapers? So these are intermediate goals that the overt group can work on. We think you ought to have an alternative on the ballot. And if we're going to have an alternative, then the parties have to be allowed to raise money, and the government has to allow them on TV and in the newspapers. So those are the kinds of intermediate goals that the overt group can work towards. It would be very dangerous for the overt group to say, we want to overthrow the government. That's not really the thing they want to say. That's for the covert group.
Okay.
The group is offering intermediate solutions which in effect allow the government to compromise. Okay, I'm not going to step down, but I will allow you to run some independent candidates, or I will allow you access to the newspapers. So that's a kind of compromise that the overt group can be demanding, and it sounds reasonable. It's not something like we're going to hang Mussolini from the nearest lamppost. I think looking at the current situation in Libya, the rebels really are saying, Gaddafi, you're going to be hanged. And they're not offering him any alternative. So the thing gets kind of bloody. He knows his life is at stake.
Right.
Apparently in Egypt, Mubarak got away. He's no longer. They're not going after him to hang him. So you want to avoid looking like you're demanding Romanian term limits. Okay, does that make sense?
That made a lot of sense. Actually, you know, we see a very similar thing that happened in Romania. Romania, in fact, with Lilo Tokic. Yes, when the Berlin Wall came down, the Romanian Communist Party didn't want to give up power. So we saw a very active overt group out there who was standing behind a minister, a priest, a reverend of some kind. I forgot which denomination, but it's not important. But they were going after him. His name was Lilo Tokic. The state was, because he was speaking out against the communists now. And people began backing him, and there really wasn't very much of a covert group there, because they were able to do things through public support, and everybody started coming out into the streets. And eventually the communist government fell for that reason.
But the dictator ended up hanging from a lamppost.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. That dictator did end up hanging from a lamppost. So,
Well, that's dangerous. If you create the impression that what you're after is hanging the dictator or shooting him, firing squad, he's got to dig in his heels. Whereas if you say we want a compromise, we want something, we want better wages, or we want free speech, or we want independent parties, whatever it is. If you sound like you're being reasonable, you're not asking the guy to commit suicide, you have a much better chance of getting some advances. And after you get the first one, it's easier to get the next one. But the important point for the overt group is not to appear like they want to overthrow the government. That's the covert group. They're out there shooting. And they want to overthrow the government. As I said before, the overt group must be in the position of saying, deal with us or you'll have to deal with these armed citizens, people. Now, the government is not going to take this passively. They're not going to take it lying down. There's a lot of things that the government can do, and the resistance, both overt and covert groups, need to be prepared for them. And one of them is creating an atmosphere of crisis. William Pitt the Younger said, necessity is ever the plea of tyrants. So whenever the government can create an aura of necessity, remember, never let a crisis go to waste. If the government can create an appearance of necessity, we have to do something. As the old joke has it, something must be done. This is something, therefore we must do it. So the government may attempt to create an atmosphere of crisis so that they can not let the crisis go to waste. One possible crisis that the government can allow, even positively create, is a crime wave. By slackening on law enforcement, they can create or allow the criminal element to create a crime wave, let the crime wave fester. Then the government can say, well, we've got this terrible crime wave we need to crack down. Gun control, movement control, identification cards, the whole nine yards.
Well, we've been seeing that happening all over the place here recently. You know, they've been cutting funding to the police. The police aren't responding to crime anymore. The crime's going up, and everybody's on their own. So we see that exact thing happening right now.
Well, we have the current case of what's being called Project Gunwalker, where the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives has evidently allowed several thousand semi-automatic AK-47s and AR-15s to be smuggled into Mexico. And they're trying now to make the claim, well, we wanted to trace who got them so we could tell the Mexicans these are the people. But there's a growing body of opinion that says, no, what they really wanted to do was increase their statistics. Look how many drug cartel guns are coming from the United States. We've got to have gun control. This recent proposal by the Obama administration to require multiple sales of long guns by gun stores near the southern border to be reported. Right now, you don't have to report them as such. Every gun buyer has to be background checked. Once the background check is passed, the buyer can buy as many guns as he wants, and the Form 1473 goes in the book at the gun store that nobody else gets reported. The ATF&E wanted to say, all right, if you do that, we want to know about it. You're creating this atmosphere of crisis in order to, according to this theory, impose more stringent gun control. So whether that's actually true or not is open to question, but it's a plausible explanation for allowing, deliberately allowing several thousand guns to be smuggled into Mexico, knowing that it was happening. The gun store owners would call the ATF and say, this guy wants 50 guns, should I sell them? And ATF would say, yes, go ahead and sell them. So the suspicion is they were trying to increase the statistics of guns in Mexico originating in the United States so they'd have a crisis that they could take advantage of, never let it go to waste, and increase the level of gun control. Another one that I think we're seeing is illegal aliens. Nobody has a right to live in a country except citizens. Any foreigner is there with permission. So if you get a flood of people coming in illegally, they are outlaws. But if the government fails to enforce border restrictions, somebody can say, well, we've got this terrible situation. We've got to have everybody with an ID card. And we already have this real ID proposal where all driver's licenses have to meet a federal standard and will be the basis for everybody's identification. Except, of course, they don't want to require ID for voters. I remember an election not too long ago where I had to go to the bank. I went to vote. Signed the sheet at the balloting place, and then I went to the bank to draw out a substantial amount of money because I had to supply some money to my kids. And a thought occurred to me, I am having to do more to prove my identity at the bank than I did when I voted this morning. And yet voting is one of the most fundamental acts of a citizen. That is your participation in the power of the rods and the axe. And surely you ought to have to prove your eligibility to vote before you can do that. But anyway, that's sort of a side issue. The illegal aliens flooding the country, creating another crisis and a demand for some kind of identification. We've got the people concerned about illegal aliens demanding the use of this E-Verify program. The government has a program where an employer can check to see if a person is legal. Well, that means everybody who wants to get a job has to be in that file. They know everybody who's getting a job and where you're getting the job. And the reason, sensible reason for it is, well, we've got to make sure that employers aren't hiring illegals. We've got now records on everybody. Propaganda, of course, is another way of creating an atmosphere of crisis. Government will say some action is necessary or it's for the public good, like the backscatter x-rays at airports. We've got to make sure nobody's sneaking a bomb on board, so we've got to scan you. Well, having created the crisis, they're now offering a solution and saying, never mind your Fourth Amendment rights, we've got to inspect you, right down to the naked skin.
Well, you know, these are problems. You've mentioned some of these problems that we're having, and, well, in our country, in the U.S., all of these seem to be expanding government control, government power into our very lives, into our homes. A lot of it seems to be destroying our very culture, in fact. Somebody had brought up a comment in the chat room as well about the food industry being completely, you know, about laws being made that will have the entire food industry of the U.S. controlled by three agri-corps. You won't be, you know, they're pushing towards this. So,
well, it's easier to control them if you've got only a few to watch.
So how do we begin the journey of creating the, you know, of working on these overt and covert groups? If, you know, if you're let's take a look at Libya, for instance. We see them rising up, but they're not following anything of what, well, they are following aspects of it, They're missing many of the aspects as well, but they've got their covert and their overt operations working up there.
Well, they've got the overt operation. There's lots of people with guns, but what's his name? The columnist, Will something or other. It doesn't matter. He was setting the column the other day. Things that we might do in Libya. One of them is, suppose we decide to supply them with guns. Surely we want to coordinate with the leaders. Well, who are they? That's the point. They do not have an overt organization. They don't have leaders that we can deal with.
Okay.
Somebody we can go to and say, we'd like to supply you with guns. Where do we take them? Even if we decided that that's what we wanted to do. They do not have the kind of the overt organization they need with people who can speak for the Libyan people. Probably it's too late to try to hide any link between the between their overt and covert groups, but apparently they don't have an overt group. There's no leadership. There's nobody we can go to and say, what do you need and where do we take it? So they need that kind of organization.
You know, I see that same problem arising in so many of these countries that have risen, you know, where the people have risen up against tyranny in the past. Whether it was a control, you know, a revolution caused by foreign influence or just the people rising up themselves. I see that the one serious aspect that they're all missing is that civil authority, that overt group that goes out there and gets the support of the people, that has an open leader, that has a clear goal, what they're trying to achieve, and what exactly it is that they want.
Yes, that's really the job for the overt group, is to say, this is what we're after, this is what we're trying to accomplish. Because without that, the rest of the people really don't know what's going on. They don't know who to follow, or whether to follow anybody. What is it that these people want? Dare I stick my neck out? Is the basic question. And until the people see somebody who says, this is what we want and here's how we're going to get it, it's not clear that, again, back to the Libyan case, the French have made some noises about supporting the rebels. But who is it that they can deal with? They apparently don't have anybody. There's nobody there that they can say, well, this is the... This is the leadership. This is the people who will speak for the rest of the Libyans. Until the Libyans can organize an overt group, one that is capable of saying, these are our goals, and we are willing to do this or that, it's a little hard to work with them. It's a little hard to say, okay, we're going to support you. Well, how do we support them? At least in the case of Solidarity in Poland, they had a leader, Walesa. We could say, all right, he's the guy we're going to talk to. He's the guy we're going to, even if it's under the table, he's the guy we're going to supply money to buy TV time and so on.
Okay, so we have the covert, or we have the overt group, the organization. We realize that we need to have a clear and defined leader or leaders, council or committee or whatever it is. We need to have somebody that we can go to, or that others can go to and say, okay, what is it that you want? What is it you're trying to get? How can we help? How can we make this happen? Whatever it is. What about the covert side? Now, I'm assuming that is going to have to be a completely different ballgame there.
Yes, definitely. The people who are in the covert organization, they don't want to be known. They don't want the government knowing who they are. And Obviously, they are going to need some support from outside. You can't think of a revolution anywhere that ever succeeded without getting guns from outside. The Viet Minh got guns from China and the Soviet Union, the Viet Cong likewise. The American Revolution, we got gunpowder from the Dutch in the Dutch East Indies. And we got uniforms and guns and other supplies from the French. So there's got to be an outside source of supply. But the overt group, the covert group has to be in a position to negotiate externally and say to potential suppliers, this is what we're up to, this is what we need, and here's how you can get it to us.
Okay. Now, what about structure? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things I was going to point out is that the phenomenon that we're seeing in the United States right now is the Tea Party. But this is, and I'm not criticizing the Tea Party. I think they're doing a good job of what they're doing. But it's a headless monster. There's nobody you can say is the leader. There's nobody you can speak for Tea Party. It's all local. If you want to say, I'm a Tea Party member and I'm going to help Joe Doe get elected in the next election, you are a Tea Party member and you're going to campaign for Joe Doe. And nobody can say, no, you're not. So while they are doing well at what they're doing, and I really support them, this is not the model for the overt organization. Person. There's nobody who can stand up and say, this is what the Tea Party wants. I don't think the Tea Party needs somebody like that. They're doing fine without it. But in a rebellion against a tyrannical government, you have to have somebody who can say, this is what we want. This is our goal. Or these are our goals. These are our objectives. These are the things we want. So the proper model for the overt organization, I think, is something like Solidarity, where you have a leader who can say, this is what we're after.
Okay.
The proper model, probably, for the covert organization is the rebels in Libya. But they are crippled because they don't have a parallel overt organization that can deal with France or deal with Saudi Arabia or deal with the United States. So these are the things we need.
Well, let's look at a good model then for that covert group. We had mentioned the, Sinn Féin? Is that what they're called?
Oh, that's the overt group. It's the Irish Republican Army that's the covert group.
Right.
The ones who were doing the shooting.
Now, let's look at another one. During the American Revolution, well, actually before the American Revolution, if we look at our history, I would say that the covert or the overt groups there would have been the committees of safety, correct?
Committees of safety and the legislatures in the colonies.
Okay.
The important thing about the American Revolution was that we had governments in place because of sort of benign neglect by the British government. We had colonial legislatures. And royally appointed colonial governors. So we already had governments in place. And in addition, we had an overt militia. Because of the Indian threats and the leftover from the wars with the French, there were organized militia units in practically every town. And these were not covert, they were open. They were supplied with taxpayer money. So we had an army in being, and we had leadership in the form of the colonial legislatures tied together by the committees of safety.
Okay.
So the legislatures and the committees of safety served as the overt organization. And we really didn't get around to a covert organization until after Lexington and Concord. with the when the militias in effect went on active duty. Now the British had there were enough loyalists running around that the British had excellent intelligence about the militias and the Continental Army, so it's not at all clear how covert they actually were. But they were separate and distinct from the committees of safety and the colonial legislatures that were raising money and signing the Declaration of Independence, promulgating the Declaration of Independence, and in effect saying, this is what we're after, these are the goals we want. Independence in particular.
Now, as far as the covert groups, you had mentioned an organization in your book, ELF, and you would use them some good points about them and some bad points and some things that you thought they could have improved upon as far as structure, some areas that they made mistakes in. You talked about from the bottom up as far as organizing for a covert group, correct?
Yes. Ideally, it should be composed of people who knew each other before and could trust each other. The guy who comes wandering in and says, hey, I'm a revolutionary. Well, how do we know who you are? The various environmentalist destructive gangs, you don't walk in and join one. You start one. And they'll be happy to cheer you from the sidelines, but they'll never reveal who else they are. One of the problems, of course, is it's a little hard to coordinate activities with something like that. All they're after is sabotage. Whereas if you really want to run a war, there has to be some coordination between the various armed groups. But this can be fairly loose coordination in the sense that, again, one of the things we found out about the Viet Cong, they were sort of given a quota. You will conduct so many raids this month. And word would come down, you'll conduct so many raids this month. And nobody told them where and when. That was up to them to figure it out. So they had a fairly loose organization. It was a structure, and people followed orders. There was an awful lot of initiative at the bottom level. We could take quite a bit of initiative in deciding what's the proper place to run an ambush this month, or where should we raid this month, what village should we attack this month. So part of the covert organization, there has to be some coordination, especially if you're going to supply them. But in addition, they have to have initiative at the bottom level. Look at the radicalized Muslims. Almost all of the instances like this shooting of the troops at whatever that fort was in the southwest, or the guy who shot up the shopping mall, or this one who was going to blow up a car bomb in New York. There was nobody in charge in the sense of a central control. These people they had gotten the word, you're supposed to take action. And then left on their own. On their own initiative, they took these actions. So that's probably too loose a model for a successful rebellion, but it's the kind of... You want to leave local initiative with groups that work from the bottom up. They know each other. They are... familiar with each other, they knew each other before, and they think they can trust each other. So what they need most, more than anything else, is supplies and some general designation. The line of the resistance is We are going to attack only government installations, or we are going to assassinate only police officials, or whatever it is, whatever the strategy has been determined by the leadership of the covert organization. But once that has been distributed to the individual units, they're pretty much on their own to take initiative and carry out some kind of an action. The Irish Republican Army was not rigidly controlled from the top. They had never more than 100 people on active service at any one time. And they were given general directions of kinds of actions they should take, but they were left on their own initiative to carry them out. So this is the sort of thing that's needed. Again, the IRA was largely people who knew each other. People, it's hard to infiltrate an organization that grows up from the bottom. The mafia was like that. The FBI had a terrible time infiltrating the mafia because it was composed of people who knew each other from before and who were brought in on a recommendation of somebody. And if you turned out to be a fink, both you and the guy who recommended you got shot. So they were pretty confident that they were getting reliable people. And it was bottom up. Once you got in the mafia, of course, you were expected to, it became like a pyramid scheme. You had to pay off the next guy up the line from your ill-gotten gains, and he paid off the next guy up the line. But the important point is, it's very hard to infiltrate an organization like that. And that's the sort of thing you want in your covert organization, something that's hard to infiltrate. People who feel they know each other, they can trust each other, and who are willing to act on their own initiative. Probably the two biggest things you need for coordination, for linking between these groups, is one is supplies. You have to supply them arms. They can't all be dependent on what they can raise themselves. Especially if you're getting supplies from a foreign supplier, there has to be a logistics organization that distributes them. And the other thing is intelligence. Each of these units is in contact one way or another, government forces, and they can gather intelligence on them. But that has to be distributed. That has to be sent to somebody who can pass it around to the other units. Well, those two kinds of coordination, logistics and intelligence, are what's really needed. Other than that, the organization can be fairly loose. It can be bottom-up. People who got together, people who knew each other and got together and say, all right, we're now a resistance unit. And following the general guidelines from the top of the resistance, they're taking actions. I'm not sure how you can... The communists tried running revolutions from the top, and most of the only successful ones that they ran that way were coups. They never really won a revolution bottom-up. South Vietnam didn't fall to the Viet Cong. It fell to the North Vietnamese Army. So... the covert wing, the armed wing, has to be a fairly loose organization that has to be tied together for logistics and intelligence purposes. How that's done is going to depend to a large extent on the circumstances of the country you're operating in.
Now I've got a question for you. As far as the relationship or the different goals of the covert and the overt group. The overt group is out there gaining, you know, hearts and minds, winning public support, getting aid and assistance from wherever they can. You mentioned the need for the covert group to also trust that overt group as well.
Yes, this is a terribly important point. You don't want a situation where the overt group sees a chance to get some kind of reward, become part of the government, and turn over or abandon or betray covert group. They have to remember that the thing that got them to the bargaining table was the guns of the covert group. They must not betray them. Well, there have been a couple of cases where apparently this has happened, or at least the covert group claimed that they were betrayed by their overt parallel group. True or not, I don't know. But it's a risk, it's a danger, and it's important that it not be allowed to happen.
Now, would an example... I'm sorry, but I was going to ask... Go ahead.
Go ahead. One more thing I wanted to say about the overt group. It must have nothing to do with getting arms, getting supplies to the covert group. It absolutely must not be in a position where it can be tainted, if you will, by being part of the covert group's logistics system. The covert group has to develop its logistics system independent of the overt group. The only connection between the two might be fundraising by the overt group that gets passed on to the covert group for purchase of supplies, but even that's risky. The overt group must maintain the appearance that they are campaigning openly for government reform. They are not trying to overthrow the government, and they are not engaged in violence. Okay, go ahead. You had something else you wanted to ask.
Yeah, correct. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I had misspoke there. You were right. Yeah, they have to maintain that separation there. What I was talking about was the overt group getting like foreign aid, you know, like you were talking about with us during the revolution. We were getting aid from France, things like that, money, coin, supplies, food, whatever it was. You had mentioned the... that when even the appearance of trust being betrayed, or somebody assuming power and then turning against the things that they had talked about, as far as the overt group goes and the covert group thinking that they've been betrayed. Mexico, I think, would Pancho Villa be an example of that? He, every time that there was a revolution against the powers that be, he would help somebody get in power that had said, you know, spoken wonderful things about what they were going to do, you know, for the people. And then he gets in power, and right off the bat, Pancho Villa, you know, he gets in power, and all of a sudden he turns on what he said, or what his campaign promises were, for instance. Pancho Villa immediately went, you know, put him in his sights, and at that point, this has happened many times in the past, and it always hasn't been a betrayal on anybody's part. It was the semblance of a betrayal, for instance, or the organization that is, like you had mentioned, infiltration, government tactics against the overt and the covert groups, both pitting them against each other, which I think would lead us into one of the other areas that we were talking about earlier, which was government response. And you had started bringing up some of that government response as far as infiltration and stuff. So how would you suggest that people take that into consideration? Did I lose you?
I'm not sure. Let's double check the...
Yeah, hang on a second. Let me pull up my thing here. Hope we didn't lose them. I think we lost them somehow. Let me try and give them a call right back. Hang on one second, everyone. I'm sorry for the problem here. Where's redial on this thing at? Hang on one second. I'm going to hang up and see if I can't reestablish contact with Joe.
Gotta love the technology. This is part of the... blowback of us being completely sovereign.
I think we lost you somehow. We lost connection. Hang on, let me bring you back on the speakerphone now, okay? I got my phone charged. We got about an hour left in the show, so let me bring you on now. Sorry about that. Okay, Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. I've got you on the speakerphone now instead of the other one. Hopefully your volume comes up in a little bit better this way. So anyways, I was asking, as far as government interaction now, you had mentioned you wanted to discuss that, and you had somewhat brought that up as far as infiltration, covert actions against the overt group and the covert group.
Yes.
What about government interaction as far as making it appear that there has been a betrayal? How would we, you know, how does that happen often? Would that be one of the antics that they would use to try and destroy that relationship or supposed relationship?
They certainly could do that. One of the tactics used by the... Still there?
Still here.
Okay, one of the tactics used by the government in the Philippines, working against the Huk Rebellion, was they would bring a column of troops into a village and go to the mayor and take him to the public square and publicly praise him for his support against the rebels. Well, whether he'd done it, whether he'd given them any support or not, from then on his name was mud with the rebels. So they could, they were guaranteed his support after that, because the rebels would never trust him again. So that's one way of in effect, turning or neutralizing somebody who is actually supporting the rebels is claim that he is supporting the government and that he has done good things for the government in terms of aiding them against the rebels. So whether he has or not, from then on, his name is mud with the rebels. Other than that, suborning somebody is probably the strongest, most likely government tactic. Remember the movie Red Dawn?
Yes.
One of the kids goes home, and he comes back with a radio tracker on him. While the movie is never really explicit on this, it's apparent that while he was home, the forces against which they were fighting put pressure on him and suborned him. So you can expect the government to try to do that.
So, let's talk now a little bit, if you wouldn't mind, about government response.
Okay. Well, I've already mentioned a few things they can do, like creating an atmosphere of crisis, so that never let a crisis go to waste. They can justify a variety of actions by saying, in view of the crisis which we're now facing, we have to do these various things like ID cards or scan you and grope you when you get on an airplane. So the government has this opportunity, if you will, to create a situation where people will be willing to give up some of their civil liberties as a means of overcoming the crisis. If they believe there is a crisis, then they may be willing to put up with it. I mean, after all, if airplanes hadn't been flown into the Twin Towers, would we be putting up with all this crap get on an airplane?
Nope.
So the government has created an atmosphere of crisis was created. whether they bungled it or whatever, I'm not ready to say they knew about it and let it deliberately happen. I don't believe that. But they certainly bungled it. Now that it happened, they've taken advantage of it. They have used it to exert more control over people. Consider, never again will somebody with a box cutter take over an airplane. We've already seen what happens when with the shoe bomber. When the passengers suspect that somebody is trying to hijack or destroy the airplane. Never again will somebody take over an airplane with a box cutter. The passengers will prevent it from happening. They are really the first responders. And yet, try taking a pair of nail clippers on an airplane. We still have the restrictions imposed on us after 9/11, even though they no longer make sense. Even though we have seen that when the passengers sense a threat, they will respond to it. They will act to take care of the threat. And yet, the government refuses to unbend, refuses to face the reality that box cutters are no longer a threat. Nail clippers are no longer a threat.
Oh, you're absolutely right there. I think what it is, you know, more kind of, you know, cracking down on us, you know, indoctrinating us, getting us used to the police state than anything else, because it's gone past ridiculous. The TSA just, you know, keeps going farther. They got the naked body scanners, and now they're going for full body x-rays. And they're not making us any safer. They're just harassing the hell out of the citizens. You know, they're killing tourism everywhere. Nobody wants to fly anymore. It's just fear. But you're absolutely right. You know, we're a lot more vigilant now. And, you know, if I was on an airplane and I saw something going down, you bet your ass I'd do everything I could to stop it. And, you know, so would most other people at this point. You know, I think this whole TSA paradigm is absolutely unnecessary. And it's not even backed by any law. It's just a policy. It's by fiat. And then they keep going farther and farther and farther with it, trying to make us safer, but yet they don't want to even secure the borders. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, example of an atmosphere crisis. I'm not going to say they created it. I don't believe they did. But they sure took advantage of it. They have created a situation in which we are essentially denied our Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure if we want to get on an airplane. And they want to do the same now for buses and trains, even though nobody's ever yet hijacked a bus or hijacked a train, and I'm not sure what they'd do with it if they did hijack it.
Yeah, for real. And they've been talking about doing that to shopping malls as well, where you got to go through the scanners and TSA security to even go shopping anymore. You know, the things they're proposing, it's just really off the chart. And you're right, it doesn't really matter, you know, who caused 9/11. The effect is just the same, whether or not it was an inside job or a bunch of pissed off Muslims. It makes absolutely no difference because, like you said, they don't waste the crisis. It doesn't matter what the origin is.
Right, and it no longer makes sense because the people will no longer put up with it. Somebody wrote on the website Free Republic the other day, even somebody with an Uzi will no longer be able to take over an airplane. And I replied, that's right. Once the magazine is empty, the survivors will make pulp out of the perp. So the whole thing is ridiculous. The people have reached the point where they are going to defend themselves. They're no longer going to sit passively and let somebody hijack the plane. So anyway, that's one thing that the government has taken advantage of, a crisis the government has taken advantage of. But creeping denial of rights is another way the government can go at it. If the people are convinced they're, through propaganda, that there's a sufficient crisis, they will put up with the salami slice technique, taking away the rights one by one. People will accept measures aimed at racketeers or terrorists or drug kingpins without recognizing that those measures will later be used against anyone. A good example is the Patriot Act, which was sold to us on the basis of dealing with terrorists. But it has been used primarily against common criminals. Now, I'm not speaking in favor of common criminals, but we were sold a bill of goods. We were told we need the Patriot Act to deal with terrorists, and yet most of it has been used, most of the time it's been used, against common criminals. Another thing that the government can do is economic pressure. I went through an audit a few months back. Boy, that was a mess. I managed to get them down from around $20,000 to something like $3,000, but I still think that was unjustified, but it wasn't worth fighting any further. But if the government wants to take care of a prominent resistance leader, one of the most useful ways would be to find something wrong with their income tax for the last 10 years. And then you're mired in tax matters forever and ever. And you no longer have the, you're busy with your own problems. You haven't got time to deal with resistance. And you might even get a subtle hint that, you know, this could all be fixed up if you just quit agitating against the government. So one of the things they can do is put economic pressure on you. If your employer has a government contract, the government can just go to your employer and say, look, do you really need that rabble-rouser on you among your employees? We can cancel your contract if you insist on keeping him on the job. Or if you need a license to practice your occupation, in the United States, there are over 700 professions, such as accountant, barber, engineer, right down through the alphabet, that require a license or some kind of certification to practice their profession. Even if you lose that license or certification, you're out of a job. And even if you have not really done anything to justify loss of your license or certification, they can harass you until you're willing to say, all right, I will quit agitating for government reform because I need to make a living. I've got to feed my family. False arrest is another government tactic, which our own government used against the Black Panthers. They would arrest them on trumped-up charges. The Black Panthers would put up money for bail, and then the government would drop the charges. But, of course, the Black Panthers never got their bail money back. It was a way of bleeding their treasury.
In your book, you also mentioned Alexander Solzhenitsyn's writings on the beginning arrests that were going on throughout Russia during this time as well.
Yes. His point, though, was more of active resistance. He said instead of cowering in your apartment waiting for the knock on the door, get a club or an axe or a poker and meet them at the foot of the stairs. And, of course, my reaction is if you can get a gun, that's even better.
This is very true.
But don't just sit quietly and let them get away with it.
Correct. In fact, that was the point I was going to bring up now was he had mentioned that in, which one was it, Leningrad? 25% of the population eventually got arrested.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
I just finished reading the Gulag Archipelago again recently. And he had mentioned that if you do nothing during these times when these things are happening, when the government is coming back on the people and they're enforcing stronger and stronger tyranny upon the people, eventually could lead to a position where, like in Leningrad, 25% of the population eventually ended up in jail. Many of them never heard from ever again.
Well, remember, many of them went not to jail, but to the labor camps.
Yes, labor camps.
And the KGB was responsible. They were in the economic plan. They were assigned a quota of output. And the only way to meet that quota was fill the labor camp with workers. So they were arresting people just for the sake of getting warm bodies. So it's more than just arresting people who are resisting the government. It's arresting, in that case, it was arresting people who were needed in the labor camps.
You know, there was a comment from the chat room saying that you were describing a grievance from the Declaration of Independence. Quote the grievance here. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. End quote.
Well, that's a very common government tactic. They will simply put out more officials, create more offices, empower more officials, and all of them are paid for out of tax money. And every one of them is doing something to harass the citizenry. It's not just if they stayed home and got their paychecks mailed to them, we'd all be better off. But they're not staying home and getting their paychecks mailed to them. They're out there in some way or other harassing us. Whether it's taxes or regulations, I was reading just recently, somebody had started to build something on their property, and the EPA got after them, wetland sort of thing, and they were told, you have to fill up the hole at your own expense, and then in 3 years we will consider letting you have a permit to do it again, to dig the hole again. Well, here are people who, in effect, are denied the use of their property by this, in effect, creeping seizure. They can't use their property, they can't do anything with their own property because they've been told you're violating some wetlands regulation. So there are lots of ways the government has to make life difficult for you. And there's nothing you can do. Even if you take them to court and win the case, you're still out an enormous amount of money. So it's one of the ways which they can, as I say, make life difficult for you and discourage you from resisting their efforts. One of the ones that I think people don't often think about, especially not in this country, is currency replacement. Now, I've been in several countries where the government periodically replaced the currency, just issued new currency and called in the old. In Brazil, for instance, they had a terrible inflation, and the government simply cut three zeros off the value of the currency. You turned in 1,000 of the old for one of the new. Well, the resistance cannot say, acquire money, if periodically the money is going to be replaced and they have to go turn it in, they're going to be asked, well, where did you get that? Are you a drug dealer? And if they don't turn it in, then it becomes worthless. A few years back, I was a visiting professor in Turkey, where at the time I was there, they were running a pretty serious inflation. And I knew I was coming back. I was going home at the end of the semester, and I knew I was coming back later. So I figured, what the heck, I will take some of this money back with me so I don't have to change it when I come back. Well, I came back a year later for the next semester, the second semester, and I started to try to use some of the currency that I had taken home with me, and I was told that's no good anymore. They issued new currency, literally chopping off 3 zeros and issuing new currency, but the old was no longer any good. So that stuff that I had taken home was now souvenirs. It was totally worthless. So one of the things the government can do to hamstring the resistance in terms of raising money is replace the currency. We saw this in Vietnam. The troops were issued not American dollars. You couldn't spend American dollars there in the post exchange or whatever. You had to exchange. You had to use military payment certificates. And these were supposedly used only in the PX or the commissary or other military activities. They were not to circulate in the Vietnamese economy. But that didn't stop the Vietnamese from accepting them and the troops from using them to buy things on the economy. Well, every so often the army canceled the old MPCs and issued new ones. And in effect, the war stopped for the day. Everybody was confined to base. Turn in your old MPCs and get new ones. Same value. They weren't changing the value, but the old ones were no longer any good. And thousands of Vietnamese would be lined up around the fence desperately trying to give their old MPCs military payment certificates to some GI to get him to change them for him, which, of course, was strictly illegal. Anybody who did it was in trouble. But that's one of the things that the government can do to prevent the resistance from building up a treasury, is periodically replace the currency, even if they don't change the value, even if they say the old is no longer any good, you've got to use the new. And currently, as I note in the book, it was a little over a year ago, North Korea introduced a new currency. They did change the value, 100 of the old for 1 of the new, but the reason, it wasn't inflation so much as to hamper the black market. There was a free market, an independent market that was outside government control. People who had dealt in this unofficial market had built up savings in the old currency, and they had to turn it in for the new currency, and it destroyed their savings because there was a limit on how much they could exchange. So this is one of the tricks the government can pull on you, is decree that we're replacing the currency, and there's lots of reasons they might do that, where the new currency is more resistant to counterfeiting, or there's a lot of counterfeit old currency circulating out there. We've got to make it worthless by putting out new currency or something. But if they limit the amount you can exchange, then they can very definitely not only make life difficult for the citizenry and confiscate your savings, in effect, but they can make it very difficult for the resistance, both covert and overt wings, to raise money, to build up a treasury.
Okay.
And that, absolutely. And one of the things that we're doing here on our end to mitigate that very kind of thing is we keep very little cash on hand. We are not very liquid. We've got lots of equipment and supplies and things like that. You know, as soon as money comes in, it immediately goes into something.
Yeah.
You know, so when they start monkeying around with the currency, it really doesn't matter because, you know, we still have, you know, assets of tangible value that can be traded, you know, back for the new currency or for other assets. And that's the best way to mitigate that, because you've got a very valid point on that, and they will start cracking down on the money to do everything they can to cripple any efforts of amassing any kind of wealth to resist the growing tyranny. You're absolutely right about that. And we kind of saw that coming a while ago, so we've taken measures to, basically have as little cash as possible.
You reminded me of something I just read recently about the, I believe it was the German inflation of the 1920s. This particular individual, people were spending their money because the value would depreciate. They were paid twice a day so that they could buy stuff before the money depreciated any further. Well, this guy went into a store and there was nothing left but diapers. Well, he wasn't married and didn't have any children, but he bought out all the diapers that he could afford because he knew someday somebody would want diapers and would be willing to pay him in whatever the new currency was for those diapers. So he was investing in commodities.
That's actually a wise idea. Things that you
it's
might
the way
not
to do it.
You know, investing in things that you might not need that you know will be in high demand later.
Right. Another move the government can make is citing for failure to comply with regulations, as I suggested before. Even if you can win the case, even if you show, yeah, I complied, you're out a lot of money for lawyers' fees. So this is another way they can harass you and make it very difficult for you, and convince you that if you really want to end all this harassment, quit opposing the government. One more way they can make it difficult for the resistance. Then, of course, there are bureaucratic sanctions. Foul up of pension checks is a good one. Whether it's you or your aged parents, suddenly the pension check quits coming. And you ask why. And, well, there's been some foul-up. They've had a report that you died. Well, it may take 6 months to prove that you didn't die. And in the meantime, you or your aged parents are without your normal income. So environmental regulations are another good one, another way to get at you.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
That was one of Hitler's big platforms as well during his whole rise to power and after he was chancellor, was the environment.
Yes, he was a big environmentalist.
So, I mean, you're pointing, a lot of these things that we're seeing now, I do a lot of reading from the UN's websites, the UN's publications, the various NGO organizations out there that just seem to have more influence on our government than we the people do.
Than we do, right.
And I read all of these things that they're talking about, and these are things that you're discussing already, and these are things that they've been discussing for decades and decades. Destroying our ability to earn money through licensing fees. You must be licensed to do this, you must be licensed to do that, and no matter what you do, you must have a business license no matter how you work. Creating licenses and having to go to the government for permission to engage in a trade. We see it with them making, our food a commodity and putting it on the commodities market now where it's open to global demand instead of, who the food really belongs to. A lot of these economic things that we're seeing these economic influence that you're talking about, we're seeing, and it's not just, they seem to be happening everywhere across the globe anymore.
Well, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you don't have enemies.
So, it's really interesting the way that you're correlating, a lot of this stuff, the things that you're speaking about have been openly written about as tools that the UN is trying to introduce to create more control globally.
Well, you got to remember, I didn't invent any of these ideas. I spent 10 years gathering ideas to put this book together, and about a year ago, I finally finished it. So, what you find in my book and what I'm talking about on your program are really things that I've read other people doing or I've seen done in other places. So this sort of thing, you see it all over the place. It is being done, and some of it's actually being done in the United States, although not yet, to the extent it's being done in some other countries. But these ideas or these things that I'm talking about are not just figments of my imagination. They're all things that either have been done or are being done and could be done again.
Well, let's talk about one of those things you had mentioned as far as government response goes. And I'd like to look back on history to what these things have led to. We talk about the government making lists now. You know, you're on a no-fly list with a TSA because you don't want to submit to a search.
Mm-hmm.
You're on a list because you belong to this organization or that organization, Tea Party or whatever. We just made the SPLC's list as a anti-government organization.
We being?
Oh, you have tread on me.
Oh, okay. Good for you.
You know, so, and I think they got the whole statement wrong. You know, I'm not anti-government. I'm very much pro-government. I'm anti-corruption like them. I think that they're anti, you know, I think that they are detrimental to a people's freedom. But they're making these lists. Everybody has, it seems like all these people are making lists, and that's another government response there, I believe, against the people themselves. Because I believe that these lists have always been used, eventually.
Right. Once you're on a list, you're not getting off.
So what if other, let's take a look at Hitler, for instance. Hitler made lists as well. How were those lists used? I know that in Russia they were making lists everywhere. You know,
this is one of the points, I think it was in, I'm having trouble with a title. It was Solzhenitsyn's novel, not his Gulag Archipelago, but his novel.
Oh, was it the Cancer Ward or his other one?
The other one.
I got it right here, in fact. Hang on a second. One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
Yes, okay. He's at one point in there, I remember, he describes somebody who thought that they had forgotten about him, that the government had forgotten about him, only to learn to his dismay that, he was still on the list. So, to borrow from Ecclesiastes, of the making of lists, there is no end.
So when you see a government, any government, anywhere in the world, any time period, when you see them making lists, is that a sign that people should be worried in that country?
Very definitely that's a sign to be worried. What are they going to do with that list? It's just like gun registration. The only purpose of gun registration is to confiscate the gun later. And the only purpose of making lists is to round people up later.
Well, you know, somebody made a good point in the chat room. The Night of the Long Knives was a list.
Yes.
In Hitler's days.
Right. Although there, I'm not sure how much of that was centrally organized. I suspect a lot of that was the thugs just went out looking for a Jewish store, that wasn't the Night of Shattered Glass. That was when they did away with the brown shirt.
The brown shirt's correct.
Yes, so that was probably more direct. They had a list. Where are these guys? So definitely. Once you're on a list, you're in trouble.
So I've got a question then. You've got the, as far as, we've talked about the organizing, you know, the structure of the organization of the covert and the overt, the relationship between the two from an academic standpoint. We've talked about the government response.
There's one thing there that is important regarding the overt organization. It should not have members. You don't want a membership-type organization. You want people who will turn out for a rally or whatever, but you don't want a membership list that they can get. The organization should be such that you've got a few people who are willing to stick their necks out and act as spokesmen, but they are not. But the organization doesn't really have a big membership, so that there's no list that they can get.
Okay.
You just want people who are willing to say, "All right, we're going to have a rally, such and such a place." Well. Let me cite an example from a couple of weeks ago. There was a pro-choice rally in Chicago. And my stepson, who is a religious brother, decided he would organize a flash mob to counter it. So they turned out, I don't know, several hundred people as a flash mob to counter the pro-choice rally. Everybody had balloons reading life. Well, that's the kind of thing you need to be able to do. You need to be able to turn out a flash mob or a group on short notice. But you don't need a membership list to do that. You just need a way of getting the word out.
Okay.
We're having this event at such and such a place and time. Show up. And until they show, you have no idea whether they're really going to be there. But you want people on the on your distribution list who are reliable. Yeah, if we send out a notice, they will come. But you definitely do not want a formal membership organization, because that makes the people on it vulnerable.
Okay.
You want to know, just names that you know, that if you call for a rally or a protest or a demonstration, they'll show up. And
well, we saw the power of that throughout the Middle East and the Northern Africa recently with these, you know, with the protests and the rebellions that are starting to rise up, you know, in Tunisia,
yeah, YouTube and Twitter.
YouTube, Twitter. I mean, it goes, you know, as far back as, what was it, Thailand recently, in fact, too. You know, they organized quickly. They were able to get people out there. There really wasn't a list or anything like that. They just did it with cell phones, Twitter, YouTube, whatever it was. They got their word out.
Well, the thing about the typical flash mob is you don't have a central list. You have a list of a few people, and you give them the word, send this to everybody on your cell phone. And that's the way it works. Instead of somebody who has a master list of everybody, you've got a list of a small number of people, each of whom you can count on to distribute the call to another handful of people, and eventually you get a fairly large flash mob. So that's really the key, is having a small list of people who are willing to send to others on their list, who in turn will send to others on their list.
Okay, so again, decentralized as well, from bottom up, not a top down organization.
Right. This is just one way of getting a turnout without a list that they can capture and harass the people. No point does anybody know. There's nobody who knows who called each of the people who shows up. They just all showed up.
Now, these flash mobs, you know, you use an interesting word there. I'm recently thinking back to several different documents that were put out. They all originated from the UN, of course. various defense departments, England, the U.S., they all put out the exact same document. A 30-year outlook on whichever country it was. The U.S. has theirs, their 30-year outlook on the U.S. They mentioned a 30-year period of increasing riots and flash mobs, but they never stated why these flash mobs would be rising. What would be the triggering points for them?
Well, I guess they figure by now people know what a flash mob is. But it's not a new idea. It's actually several years old. And it became feasible with the wide availability of cell phones. Because then you could... An individual could send a text message to everybody on his list. Say, send this on to everybody on your cell phone, and nobody along the chain is responsible for knowing who's organizing it.
They just agreed to show up.
They just agree. They just say, "All right, I'll show up." And the people who start it obviously have some reason to believe that the people to whom they send the first call, the first text message, will forward it. But once that happens, it's out of their control. People are sending these messages to their own friends. And nobody can say, well, this was organized. You organized this. Well, no, I didn't. I had nothing to do with it. I just sent this message to my friend because I thought he'd be interested. So that's really the origin and the idea behind a flash mob. It makes it possible for people to organize something on short notice and get the word out. Very little in the way of formal structure.
Okay.
Just send it to everybody on your cell phone or selected people on your cell phone. Maybe there's some you don't want to send it to. But essentially you send it to a list of people and ask them to forward it. And to the extent that they do, you've got a flash mob showing up. Now why lists that you're referring to are concerned about flash mobs, I don't know, but they are certainly a very powerful tool for organizing people.
So now, what are some of the concerns with flash mobs? I know that in reading these various documents, for instance, we'll just, the one that came out of the UN, Britain, I believe, labeled it the Summer of Rage.
Well, that's, I think that's drawn from, well, at least in Saudi Arabia, this past Friday was to be a day of rage. After Friday is the Muslim holy day, and after the Muslims left the mosque, they were supposed to go to some central place and protest. And I have not heard how well that worked out. In fact, I haven't been able to get much news today.
Well, one of the questions I have for you is, let's talk about the government interaction, the government reaction there. And if you're looking at a really tyrannical system, a very iron-fisted government, what kind of precautions would there need to be for the flash mobs? I mean, if they just show up and within minutes, you're going to have the military on you.
Well, that's one of the things about a flash mob is it catches the government by surprise. Because you can do it on fairly short notice. And when people start suddenly showing up, and you've got several thousand people in the marketplace or whatever, the government doesn't even know about it until it's happening, is the key point. That's why it's a flash mob. It's, if you organize, say, you put up a poster, like I've seen it in other places, rally at such and such a square on such and such a day, well, the government is going to find out about that just as well as the people who whom you want to show up. But the nice thing about a flash mob is they are there before the government even knows that something's happening, because everybody has passed the word quickly, and those who are willing to show up have done so. They are already there.
So what should be the purpose of these flash mobs? Would they be part of the more? I'm assuming that these would be part of the overt organization.
Oh yes, they're part of the overt organization, definitely.
So, what would be the purpose behind these flash mobs?
Well, the purpose behind them is to organize a protest of some kind, whatever it is, and that's one of the things that becomes key. If you're going to call for a flash mob, there has to be a purpose. You can't just call people out to stand around. There's got to be a purpose, and you don't want to be caught by surprise yourself. I refer in the book to one case where the group called for a rally, and they were totally caught short by the number of people who showed up. They didn't have loudspeakers. They didn't have pamphlets. They didn't have any of the paraphernalia that you'd want if you were really organizing a protest rally or a protest march. So you've got to be prepared for success. Yes, you want the people to show up, but you have to have something for them to do when they get there. You need a loudspeaker on hand. The group that I mentioned, this pro-life group, they had a backpack loudspeaker. They just marched into the Daily Square in Chicago with balloons concealed in garbage bags. And once they were all there, they turned on the loudspeaker and pulled the balloons out of the garbage bags and passed them around. So you need to be prepared for success. You need to be prepared for the people who actually do show up. But getting them there is the key point for a flash mob. You have no idea, because you're not in, you don't have a centralized communication list. You have no idea who's going to be there, who's going to show up. But you call for the protest on short notice, and somebody shows up, and you want to be ready to pass out signs or protest literature or whatever is the purpose of your flash mob. The idea being want them to, if you say if it's to protest some government measure, then you want flyers or whatever to let the people know this is what we're here for. This is the purpose. We're going to sign a petition, or we're going to protest this activity on the part of the government, whatever it is. So the key point is you've got to have a purpose for the people when they get there. But the idea behind the flash mob is you organize them quickly so the government has no chance to react. They can't intervene because they don't even know about it until the people show up.
Absolutely. I'd have people show up with their video cameras as well and be ready to have an exit strategy, so when they do figure out what's going on and start cracking down, it disperses as quickly and it just shows up somewhere else. You know, you stay highly mobile, you know, where they're just chasing their tail trying to find you.
Yeah, that's another point which I didn't mention in the book and should have, is you want cameras on site, lots and lots of cameras. And you want cameras aimed at some of the camera holders so that you can video the attacks on the camera holders. So videographer number two is videoing the attack on videographer number one and gets out of there in a hurry and posts it on YouTube.
Okay. Question for you now. How do you keep a mob from becoming, these flash mobs from becoming just that, a mob?
That's part of having a purpose for them. You've got to be ready for them with something to pass out or a loudspeaker or something so that they don't just stand there. You want to be ready for them to follow up on whatever the purpose was that you brought them together. If you're protesting whatever, you're protesting, say, a recent government regulation, okay, you've got to have petitions for them to sign, or you've got to have posters, or you've got to have flyers to hand out. You have to be ready for to give them something positive so that they don't start rioting. You want to be able to say, okay, we're here, and here's what we're here for, and we want you to sign these petitions, or we want you to pass out these leaflets, or we want you to whatever it is. But that's key, is having a positive action for them to take when they get there, so that they're not becoming a mob. That's part of successfully preparing for the thing.
I think that's important, because if it turns into a mob, you end up getting the public support that you were going after. It ends
right.
up turning they end up turning against you when the general public's shop windows are busted in, when they're looted, when they're attacked, even.
Yes. Now this
when you hurt them financially.
This is one of the problems of the. What was that thing in Seattle where the I can't remember the name of the world organization that was holding a meeting there, and a bunch of the Ruckus Society and a bunch of anarchists showed up, and they basically wasted their opportunity because they broke windows, they did all kinds of things that turned people against them. And part of the reason was when the crowd showed up, there was really nothing for them to do. Nobody had planned for a positive action. And I think that's critical. You've got to be ready for people to show up. You have to have something ahead of time, something planned ahead of time for them to do when they get there. Even if I recall reading of a mob. Not a mob, it was really a demonstration in Yugoslavia under Tito. And you really didn't dare do much in the way of opposing the Tito government. But these people just showed up and stood silently in the public square. They didn't say boo, but they just stood there. And the people in the government knew that they realized what was going on. These people are unhappy, they're against us, and they're not doing anything that will trigger a crackdown. We can't justify beating them up or doing anything of the sort, but we are they are letting us know that they don't like us. So maybe sometime the best thing to do is just show up and keep quiet. Especially if you know that taking some violent action is going to result in a crackdown. Just showing up and standing there quietly may be enough to get the message across to the government that we're not happy with you. And when I read that, I thought, gee, that's really ingenious. I don't know whether somebody thought of it or the crowd just did that automatically when they got there. They knew that if they did something violent, that it would trigger a reaction, so they didn't do anything. They just stood there.
I think that's awesome.
But it's important to have something positive for the people to do when they show up. It's got to be a purpose for the rally or whatever, and there's got to be preparation so that when they show up, you can achieve that purpose. And like I said, have loudspeakers, have, even if it's a backpack loudspeaker, even if it's nothing but a bullhorn, and have pamphlets or whatever it is you want them to be doing.
You know, that was the one, you know, that's the one thing that you were talking about earlier was keeping that public support, and I think that is so important. We're not going to create change by any means whatsoever. And you delved into this a little bit in the previous shows, specifically talking about public support for supplies, equipment, food, whatever it is that you need, even just information.
Yes, one of the things that the covert group must develop is a system for letting people inform of government activity. Are troops on the move? Are airplanes flying? Remember in the movie Black Hawk Down, they showed this a kid with a cell phone holding it up when the helicopters came over to let somebody at the other end know that the American helicopters were on their way. Now, whether that really happened is not relevant. The point is, this is something that can be done. This is a you want to organize an intelligence gathering organization where the people are part of your network for informing you of what's going on. I recall back during World War II, we used to have these watchers who were supposed to be watching for enemy airplanes. Well, back in Ohio, it was very unlikely that we were going to get any enemy airplanes that far in, but we still had those people with their binoculars doing these watches. For a while, I was dating a girl who was signed up for that. She had a regular watch. Every so certain times, she'd be out there looking. So these are things that the public can do, and the covert wing, the armed wing, has to bring the public in to do these things, and they have to do it in a way that doesn't endanger the members of the public by giving the government something to respond to. If you've got a kid holding up a cell phone when the helicopters come over, once the helicopters are gone, he disappears into the crowd. It's going to be hard to track him down or do anything. So you need to organize a community watch, if you will, that will report to the armed wing when things are happening. Back during World War II, the Flying Tigers in China organized Chinese with radios. When the Japanese airplanes went over, they'd call in. Some of the airplanes going over at such and such in such and such a direction. It wasn't as good a radar, but it was better than being caught on the ground. So you want to organize this kind of thing. And it's very important for the armed wing to bring that into the support. And do it in a way that does not risk the people forming the support.
Well, Joe, we are down to our last 4 minutes or so. I want you to take this last few minutes, close us out where you want to go, but also get your book information out there for everybody, please.
Okay, well, the title, as we've said before, is Resistance to Tyranny. It's available from Amazon under that title, Resistance to Tyranny. I'm not aware of the current price. I haven't checked regularly or recently, but I think it's in the order of $13. So I'm not trying to make a fortune out of this. I want to get the word out. So I urge people who are concerned about the way things are going to get copies and prepare themselves. And, of course, I'm not focusing on any specific country. There are probably lots of countries in the world where an armed revolt is justified, Libya being one of them, and I don't know whether to sympathize with the folks there or not, but certainly Gaddafi is no prize. So it's not just people in the United States, although I agree with you, every militia unit, every Committee of Safety ought to have a copy of this book. But there are countries in the world where I think they need it too. And I hope that they will take advantage of the opportunity to get it while it's still available.
I agree with you wholeheartedly on that one. In fact, we were asked to get on the United We Strike marathon each month. And we did a little pre-recorded 20-minute blurb for them, and I started talking about that very thing. The things that we talk about on this broadcast, these concepts, these ideas, these are not just for America. These are for any country, any people out there who want to be free.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, whatever your freedom looks like, it doesn't have to be like our freedom. It could be whatever your freedom looks like. And that's a great thing, because it's up to you to choose what your freedom's going to look like.
This is one of the things I think we missed the boat in Iraq. We tried to replicate an American-style government where we should have tried to let them have a government that fit their culture. And I hope the Tunisians and the Egyptians learned a lesson from that. Have a kind of government that lets you be free but fits your culture.
Exactly. Everybody's free to choose what their own form of freedom and justice looks like for their own people and their own country. I completely agree with that. You know, I would encourage everybody to take a look at the American Revolution, though, and the war that led, you know, and the war that was the product of the American Revolution, because that's the only one in history that's ever worked and freed a people, even if for a little while. So, you know, hey, if the wheel's not broken, don't fix it. Well, listen, Joe, I appreciate you coming on again. In fact, you know, if it's good with you, I'll get back with you later, but I would like to get you on again.
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
I know we've got a lot of things to cover in your book, and to be honest with you, I tell everybody this. You are one of my favorite guests of all time that I've ever had in all the years I've been doing this.
I'll be glad to come back on when the opportunity arises.
Perfect. I will get in touch with you about that again soon then, and we'll make it happen. So, Joe, I appreciate you coming on. I thank you so much for your book. Everybody out there, I encourage you. I encourage you to buy it. I encourage you to, if you have to beg and borrow, it doesn't matter. You need this book. It's the only product out there that I push ever. It's the only thing I've ever found worthy of me getting behind, to be honest. I don't push other people's stuff. This one I do. So get the book, read it. Start looking at it and decide for yourself what is necessary in your area, what role you're going to play, and how it's going to fit into your life. So with that being said, everybody, thank you for listening in. Joe, thank you for coming on. Everybody be safe, be free. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.